philosophy, it was clearly pointed out that this total suspension was not extinction, that it was not the end, that it was not materialism, that it was not nihilism, that it was the invitation to the first experience of what we call consciousness and know nothing about. In other words, we have a polarized state, a state of consciousness and unconsciousness, and we have reversed them. What we call consciousness, the ancient sage called unconsciousness. What we call waking, he called sleeping. What we call our daily objectivity was his nightmare. Plato pointed out that heaven is not the place, the hell is not the place where you go when you die, but when you are born. Everything is reversed. But what we call consciousness today is really the conflict, the pressure, the stress, the irritation of factors uncontrolled, undirected, unmastered, and therefore out of conscious direction. That instead of being conscious today, we are the victim of a series of sensory cycles, mistaking reflexes for consciousness, mistaking notions for consciousness, and depending entirely upon opinion to supply the substance of what we like to call knowing. As a result of that, what we call knowing is unknowing. What we call wisdom is truly the foolishness of God. What we call progress may be motion or commotion in any direction whatever, because we have no visual or vital concept of what direction progress should take. Thus, we assume that all motion is the sign of life, and if there is commotion with it, then the individual is really alive. On the basis that commotion is the proof of animation, we are going along very well. But if we are to assume that there is purpose in any, then are we doing so well? And if we have no awareness of purpose and have no strength of character by means of which we choose to protect value at all costs, if we lack these strengths within ourselves, are we conscious? Or are we merely responding to the pressure and stimulation of sensations? Are we really conscious beings or merely sensory beings? Most persons are probably mostly sensory beings, because if you block the five senses completely, they would have very little record to tell, or very few experiences to report, and not very many opinions to circulate. Our entire so-called awareness is based upon our ability to contact a series of environmental circumstances. Our opinions are derived from the papers we read, the television programs we listen to, the neighbors who talk over the back fence. All of these things arise from outside of ourselves and become the basis of our internal reaction to things. Thus, we have two kinds of an outside life. One kind of life, which is outside in the sense of outside the body. The other is an outside life inside the body, but outside of consciousness. Thus, what we call our inner life is merely our external environmental life flowing in through our sensory perceptions and loading us with confused testimonies of one kind or another. Against this procedure, we have little or no motion from within ourselves of a true life or a consciousness. We might say, we probably should say, that without consciousness, we would be unable to record these external factors. That means, however, that we are using consciousness only as an energy, using it as we would electricity, as a blind force, merely a servant of certain purposes of our own. The Academy of France decided that there were two kinds of electricity, that which was intelligent and that which was not. And what we call consciousness today is probably mostly a phase of energy which would be compared to intelligent electricity. Consciousness now merely supplies us the energy by means of which we can arrive at certain conclusions or perform certain actions. The motivations behind these conclusions and actions being sensory and bodily, and not arising from consciousness itself. If this be true, the average person has had very few examples of consciousness in his lifetime. He has not experienced the pure control of his life by internal value alone. It is not certain that he would know how to define consciousness if he experienced it. Perhaps the mystical experience would come somewhat near to it. But consciousness is certainly a moving from within the individual of a solutional energy. An energy which solves or completes or apperceives these things which are otherwise merely intellectual and emotional forces. Buddha held this to be inevitable, that what we know as consciousness is not, and what we aspire to conceive of as consciousness, the real, is a positive pole as yet practically unknown to man. But this consciousness is known to man only in one respect, namely that it manifests as the fact of his existence, which is the only fact that he possesses. That consciousness as he knows it may be at best merely a capacity. Instead of being something which we have developed, and so it is really almost superhuman, it is a capacity. It is something which says to us in some way, you can understand if you want to. That there is within you the potential power to know. That in some mysterious way you can be. But having the power to know, we do not know. Having the power to be, we doubt our own exact existence. Consciousness is therefore a kind of capacity. It shows that in some way man is capable of achieving to a state of reality. Consciousness is therefore both the capacity for this and the reality to be achieved. It might be philosophically sound, therefore, to think of ourselves not as conscious beings, but as beings groping for consciousness, which some way permeates us and fills our existence, yet with which we are not in rapport. It is as though we were a kind of fish in an ocean of life, and yet unaware of this ocean, that we are in the midst of an unreality, or we are in the midst of a reality but live a total unreality. that nearer to us than ourselves on every part of our nature is an all-pervading potential. And yet, this potential has not been able to cause us to achieve to any particular state. Yet this potential may bestow upon us certain things. One is continuity, that behind the generation of species, behind the fact that man simply is a creation which has refused to die, that in this alone is a continuity of life which is rooted in consciousness, a consciousness of life that is stronger than death. Another possible phase in which consciousness may be dimly recognized by us is this subtle but continuing urge within us to be better. This sensing of our own in unlimited capacity, that in some way we are using consciousness without knowing it, that we are assuming that there is no horizon to limit us but our own achievement, that we can be anything that we will to be, do anything that we will to do. Somewhere in the root of ourselves there is the archetypal impulse that we should will to do that which is soul, that which is true, that in our questing our final search must be for value, for that which is so. And this recognition that some way we have the capacity to find what is so, and that we consist of an immortal essence that will continue until this victory is achieved. Perhaps these sleeping elements of conviction within our own nature, but partly expressed, but partly articulated in living, may be pressures from this positive pole of consciousness. In psychology, for example, we have a subconscious and an unconscious as divisions of the internal life of man. We differentiate these from what we call the conscious. But it is my suspicion that we have made a complete reversal. But what we call the unconscious is on the outside rather than the inside. That man actually moving inward moves toward consciousness and not away from it. If this be potentially true, then some of the choicest of our modern aphorisms will have to be revised. Because if the pressure is on the outside rather than on the inside, as we have been affirming that it is, then what we need is discipline on the outside rather than relief. We have an elaborate problem here that goes into a great many phases of human life. But the actual answer seems to be that psychology, up to the present time, has never yet dealt with the plus qualities. It has never dealt with that which is the root of things. It has never assumed that the root was the reality. It has always assumed that within man is locked a mass of unreality. That is true to a certain degree. But we must penetrate those unrealities, which belong essentially to our objective lives. For these unrealities arise out of our mental, emotional stress. They do not arise from spiritual value, nor do they arise from consciousness, but rather from the deformities of consciousness on the level of sense and emotion. The search inward, therefore, must go past this, must go past this mystery that the magicians and Kabbalists of the Middle Ages called the mystery of the astral life. This mystery of illusion, and must go further in search of that which is pure, positive consciousness. In this, perhaps, free consciousness, and perhaps even beyond archetypes, which up to the present time has seemed to be the direct emergence of consciousness. I think we may go on, as the Buddhist has pointed out, to the discovery of pure consciousness as absolute suspension of action, with the absolute suspension, therefore, of all polarized existence and all time, space, distance equations. If, then, we do approach the ultimate nature of consciousness, we are likely to find it as Laozi described in Tao, namely a totality, a something into which everything is finally absorbed, a something which is this eternal capacity, forever devouring its own offspring, as Cronus devoured all his children. In this sense also, we can understand, perhaps, how the mystic, in his search for consciousness, has therefore passed through the search on the level of clamor, a search on the level of glamour also. He is no longer concerned with trying to adjust himself to environment. He is seeking to adjust himself to principle, to cause within himself, realizing that if he can do so, he can never be out of harmony with environment. But some way, all problems have to be solved somewhere within the field of consciousness. There are no problems to be solved in the world as we see it. There are no problems that can actually be solved on the level of emotion and sense. All problems have to be causally solved, and have to be solved as experiences of conscious awareness. And to achieve this end, then, the problem of the retirement of the individual toward samadhi, or toward the nirvanic state, has been not only the teaching in the East, but in your Christian mysticism, the same idea. The same basic detachment from objectivity in the search for consciousness. Now another point has come in where we have to realize that a term like consciousness may also go into theology and be changed into something else. Your Christian mystic, I'm thinking of several outstanding examples, perhaps St. John of the Cross is as good an example as any. Your Christian mystic has always taken the attitude or the opinion that there was a mysterious power in space which he called the grace of God. This is a mysterious something, a kind of baptism, a magnificent and mysterious water of holiness, something that came to man out of the infinite, and of which apparently he had little understanding or true insight. Yet coming into the presence of this thing, he was completely and entirely altered, picked up, lifted out of death and of doubt, and by this peculiar kind of grace became radiant with the love of God and with the realization of eternity. Now it is conceivable to us that this so-called grace of God, of your Christian mystic, which is to be discovered only when man has transcended this world, that it is this a way in which he has attempted to explain a dimension of consciousness which otherwise cannot easily be explained. Also, we realize that the so-called miracles, particularly such miracles as those performed at Lourdes, do not represent a merely intellectual approach toward religion. Thousands of pilgrims reach Lourdes for help every year, only a small percentage is actually cured. But this small percentage represents a group of persons to whom a particular experience has occurred. An experience of such tremendous intensity of some kind that it has broken through a pattern of common attitude and belief. Your Eastern and your early mystics will take the ground that this experience arose from the complete detachment of the individual from worldliness. That in some mysterious, sensitive way, the world died in man. And that in this moment of complete suspension between heaven and earth, man became aware, perhaps, or cognizant of the fringe on the vestment of consciousness. The consciousness begins, actually, where what we know as living ends. That it is not to be confused and is irreconcilable with the kind of life that we know. That it remains always within itself. That it is a kind of seed from which all life comes and to which all life must return again. For if life had an origin, it arose in consciousness. If it has a destiny, that destiny must be its return again to consciousness. Now, the question that we asked earlier this evening, if consciousness is a certain kind of positive attitude, how is it that man could ever descend from a perfect state into an imperfect one? This question must be answered by another question. Does consciousness, in its own nature, represent this all-knowing state? Is consciousness that kind of an awareness? The evidence of nature is that this is not. That consciousness is not the kind of thing by which all things are filled and therefore becomes a positive energy by which all forms of life can be directed. Consciousness, apparently, as Buddha and the Vedantists and Taoists have all sensed, is total life in total and eternal suspension. Therefore, it has to be total life with total suspension of will. Hence, consciousness must be total life without purpose, yet capable of fulfilling the purpose that can arise in the unfolding awareness of all creatures. Like a dark earth into which 1,000 different children can plant 1,000 different seeds, and in which each of these seeds will grow, consciousness must be an infinite capacity in which all things are possible. But this possibility must arise from the experience of living things rather than be imposed upon it. Upon living things by consciousness itself. Therefore, the actual fact of consciousness is that it does not move, nor does it lead to motion. It is rather the end of motion. And that which is united with it becomes immovable. And because it is without motion, it is eternal. And because it does not move from one state or condition to another, it is unchangeable. Thus, by degrees, as we take away from the concept of consciousness all that limits, all that cannot be truly adjusted to even our immature idea of what totality could be, by degrees we strip away from consciousness all illusion, all delusion, and all error. That which remains undefinable, but it does have a complete freedom from all of the terms and attitudes with which we are familiar. Thus, in the ancient idea of things, Tao, or consciousness, in its two things. Was this great ocean into which life returned? It was this tremendous cup that captures and holds life. It is this wonderful sea, this ocean, into which all life flows from innumerable fountains and rivers, and the sea remains unchanged and immovable. Now in Buddhism, if life theoretically moves from this state of ignorance along the path of discipleship and liberation, until finally, through the total suspension of error, it reaches this tremendous sea of life, merges itself with it, and vanishes like the drop of water returning to the great sea. What then follows? Buddha does not tell us in his discourses, but he implies and intimates certain things. He said to his disciples that he did not answer these questions because the answers are not profitable. He said, I know many things that I have not told you, but to tell you will gain you nothing and only lead to abstract controversy over subjects about which such controversy cannot be meaningful nor profitable. But this he does say definitely, that we are not to assume that this reabsorption actually means extinction or the termination of the vast motions and processes of life in nature. What he seems to be trying to tell us, if we can read between the lines, is that actually his fable or his analogy is based upon the same idea as that of Plato and the race that lives at the bottom of the well. It's supposed to have been the fable that there was a whole race of creatures that lived at the bottom of a hole in the ground. And these people wrote books and became very learned and wrote and described the universe, just how it was made and everything, and explained that the universe was the hole in which they lived, that there were no other holes, and that there was no other place in space except their home. That they all lived here together, and that the entire knowledge of the race, of the world, of everything, was contained in this hole in the ground. Well, after a long time, there was produced out of this race of people living in the bottom of the well, a one daring soul, who was able to notice that far up above there was a little patch of light coming down. And they told him that this patch of light, of course, was God. And that therefore, that all you did to it was worship it. But this fellow kept looking up and watching this patch of light, and he saw that at night it disappeared and things like that, and he began to get very interested. And at last, he gained the courage to climb up the side of the wall of the well. It was a very difficult journey, but he ultimately achieved it, and finally came to the edge of the top of the well and looked out upon the world around him. And he saw mountains and plains and people and animals and birds, and he saw grass growing and flowers and rivers and all kinds of things, and he suddenly realized that there was a great world up here that no one previously had appreciated or understood. So he hastened down the well to share the good news with all his friends below. They pronounced him mad and refused to even climb the well and take a look. And when he insisted upon this procedure of going around and telling them about what was happening up above, they finally decided that he was not only mad but dangerous, and it was up to them to confine him and make certain that he no longer perverted the public morals of the people living at the bottom of the well. And the story apparently is a clever takeoff by Plato on the trial of Socrates, the man who dared to take a look over the top of the well and see what was going on in the larger universe. The analogy to consciousness, I think, is this: that what we call living, what we call consciousness today is the common conviction about value of the people living at the bottom of the well. Somewhere along the line, great prophets, messiahs, teachers, sages, and saints have dared to climb the wall, or have climbed the wall, taken a look around and come back and told people that that is not the way it really is. These saints have all, of course, been regarded as neurotic, or perhaps as mad, and when they were too successful in describing the situation, they were conveniently executed for the protection of their fellow men, lest others take the delusion. Thus, by degrees, we have locked ourselves in the bottom of the well, destroying everyone who tried to bring us out. In our personal lives, we have locked our consciousness in the bottom of the well of our sensory perceptions, our environment, our traditions, and most particularly of authority, which has been the deciding of our minds for the minds of others. Out of all of this situation, we have a new concept of consciousness. Or rather, in this case, consciousness is the way things are outside the well. If then we go up to the top of the well, finally, and take a look around, we come into a world that is totally different from anything that we have known. We cannot go back and explain it, because those who live at the bottom of the well have no words or thoughts suitable to understand what we have seen, because they have not seen. But this is not where the analogy ends, and Plato very astutely pointed out the next point, namely, that when man's own internal energy, by the mystical experience, are able to contact the world above the well, or outside the well, and this experience returns again to the sensory factions of man's nature, his own emotions, his own thoughts, his own mind cannot accept or understand. They cannot find the symbols necessary. Therefore, the individual returning from an experience of that kind cannot record it to his own consciousness or his own personal life. He does not know how to bring this experience through to his objective awareness. Thus, a pure experience of consciousness probably could not be remembered, because it would not awaken any association mechanism by which it would be tied to the presently familiar. Thus the ecstasies described of the saints and the mystics have always been something exceedingly wonderful. That's all. Something about which there can never be any clarity of explanation. Once also the individual who lives down in the bottom of the well climbs up to the surface and comes out of the well, as far as the people of the bottom of the well are concerned, he is gone forever. He is dead. He has ceased to exist. He has gone forth into a non-existent place, which means that he has to be a non-existent being to function. No one ever expects him to come back, and he probably does not, but not for the reason that is assumed. Not because he does not want to come back, but because he has found a larger world and prefers to function there. In the experience of consciousness, it follows that once the being attains to this consciousness, attains to the nirvana, which is to reach the surface of the ground and look out, for those below, it is the end of everything. He's gone. For himself, it is the beginning of reality, for he has just found out the fact. And somewhere in the compound psychical equipment of man, there is this point where man departs from the error and discovers the fact. Just where this point is remains psychologically obscure. we do not know. But this tilt from error to reality is a larger difference than we have imagined. Reality is not just our present illusions with some minor reformation. It is not just 1% more added to the 99% of what we know now. Nor is it a shuffling around of these existing factors into a new pattern. According to the ancients, consciousness, when it awakens, is an instantaneous and complete transformation of everything. Everything moving from death to life, from appearance to fact, from the things as they seem to be to the eternity of thing as it is. And what appears to be and what actually is, these are so different from each other that we have no cognition of it. We are still hoping that we are going to gradually push our way along the line of science, discovery, and art, and all these subjects, and that we are pushing our way into the presence of truth. That one by one, our mistakes are disappearing, and our virtues are multiplied, and our abilities are intensified, and we have made this marvelous and magnificent thing called progress, and that at almost any minute now, we're going to wake up in the millennium. We've always had that feeling, but for some unknown reason, the millennium has been a little slow in appearing. And at the moment, it does not seem as close as it did last week before the Lebanon situation, because quite as tense as it is now. Just about the time when it looks like we were really arriving, we invent something else. I have to start all over again to try to put the world back in order. Actually, there is a question as to whether we'll ever win this game. Actually, the probabilities are that fact of the matter is something that we will never collectively attain in the common meaning of this word. There will probably never be a day when there will be a mass exit from the bottom of the well, when everyone all at once will say, let's go. In the first place, there are a lot of people who do not want to leave the bottom of the well because it's cool and damp down there anyway. Of course, they may have pneumonia most of the time, but still they've grown accustomed to it. Next thing you might say is that it is cozy down there. Everybody knows everybody. Everybody has the same faults. Everyone is proud of them. Another thing about it is that there's a barter and exchange system down in the bottom of the well there that has been working for a long time. And there are all kinds of wonderful institutions like prisons and poor farms and wonderful pension systems and all kinds of things down in the bottom of the well. Excellent police systems, fire departments, and of course, regular clinics for the psychoanalysis of individuals who would dare to try to climb out of the well. So who wants to leave such a delectable place? However, in every generation, as has been proved in history, there are some who are born with adventure in their hearts. They simply cannot conform. They are born that way. It means that a certain maturity of consciousness is beginning to manifest itself. They are still part of this mystery of the well body, but they are rebels against it. And we find the non-conformists. We find that individual who is sometimes called the crank that makes the world go round and takes the crank now and then to do it. So we have the free thinker. We have the nonconformist who becomes an object of some concern to others. Therefore, they are rather happy to see him depart on his long journey, and they hope he will not come back. To him, it is an adventure. To them, it is a well-justified punishment for the general attitude that he has taken. So he climbs out of the well.
by degrees.
But this is not going to be a common motion, because it means to separate oneself from authority, from tradition, from ancient policies, and from immediate profit and advantage. The individual who is so short-sighted that he can conceive mostly of his standard of living today only, and would rather perpetuate all of the misfortunes of his race than hazard it, is of no mood to climb out of the well. So only the occasional person does. But some way those persons live and have become the great leaders of our race. For it is necessary occasionally for some prophet even to return to the well and die there, in order that those at the bottom of the well should know about this other world. I think Buddha, to a measure, did this, because I think he was one of those who was able to have the awareness of consciousness by seeing the world of reality. No longer mountains and gardens and valleys, but the realization that what we call consciousness is not a miraculous or incredible thing. It is simply man climbing out of unconsciousness and coming into a world that has always been there, and the world that he really belongs to. A world that is perfectly natural and normal, something that he has never known. Because there is nothing that he is experiencing now that is either natural or normal. But he doesn't know it. His miseries have become normal. His catastrophes have become natural. The uncertainties of his world have become acceptable. And I read not long ago a rather important modern book which simply faces the fact that we might as well face it. There will always be wars. There will always be crime. Man is built that way. So that is the attitude. These things we accept as normal. We regard peace with certain misgiving. Perhaps it will represent a depression in the long run because there won't be enough markets to get rid of our surplus. Peace is not what we are looking for. We are looking for immediate convenience and comfort and security. But we will hazard security to retain advantage. Thus, all this world with its education, with its arts and its sciences, all this is some way not consciousness. It is not real. It isn't an illusion in the sense that you can put your finger through the middle of it. It isn't there. It is there. But it is illusional in the sense of value. It is an illusion, as the men in the bottom of the well are to the person who is no longer there with them. It is the proof that we can make things that have no value so important to us and hold this attitude for so many ages that we become incapable of conceiving of anything more important. But once consciousness comes out, or the being comes out of the well into positive consciousness, what kind of a world is it going to be? Is it simply going to be a reformed world of our own? Probably nothing even resembling it. It is going to be a state that we cannot adequately define, probably bearing no resemblance to anything that we know at all. But it is a state of truth, of fact, of actual validity, in which things that now hope, fear, believe, and doubt come to a state of knowing. Knowing being, in this case, the factual participation in a conscious reality. You may find that in that state, that as some of the Easterns felt, that consciousness absorbs us. We become parts of it. That only consciousness itself goes on. And that this consciousness that goes on is normalcy, is real, and is eternal. And therefore, that when we come out of the hole and come into the gardens at the upper end of the well, we come into an eternal state. A state which is, however, eternal and timeless both, in which there is no sense of anything, but an eternal now. Perhaps memory and thought, as we know them, will no longer exist. Perhaps sensory reflexes will have completely ceased. We will have an entirely new structural nature with which to respond to impulse. All of these things seem conceivable. And in this, we go back, or go forward, or we go toward that which preceded our present state, and from which, in some mysterious way, we departed. How did we get to the bottom of the well in the first place? Were these creatures engendered there? Probably not. They don't tell us in the story just how they got there, but we can take some isolated cases. For instance, some of our Western Indian tribes have decided to make their homes 4,000 feet down in the Grand Canyon or something of that nature. Why did people go down in the well? Well, perhaps for protection, originally. Individuals seeking protection nearly always exterminate himself, like the Chinese who built the wall around China to keep everyone else out, and all it did was kept them in. Then, another thing, perhaps a man fell down the well at some remote time. Or perhaps in some very ancient day, there was a migration down the well to explore it. There was trouble getting out again, and after ages, men gave up trying to get out. Perhaps this is also the story that is behind the fall of man. But the human being, because of body, which is the well in which he is caught, and because of the exigencies of survival, fighting against the saber-toothed tiger, fighting against the tremendous forces of a prehistoric world, where man was nothing, the animal creation around him was monstrous and horrible. The very processes of survival, the creation of the stone axe and the cave, the discovery of fire, all these ancient problems kept man very much occupied. He was struggling to survive physically in a world of mystery. Perhaps by the time he got this survival partly worked out, he had forgotten that once upon a time he had crawled down the sides of the well. He was down there now, locked into it by the very thousands of years in which he had struggled merely to keep body and soul together in this world. He had no time for reflection, no time for dreams and ideas. By the time he had the time, he had lost the inclination. He was locked within a pattern from which he must extricate himself in some mysterious way. It would be interesting, and I think quite conceivable, to assume, therefore, that this pre-conscious world, this thing which preceded consciousness as we know it, is true consciousness. What we know as consciousness is not consciousness at all. It is simply man's aggregate of awareness faculties by means of which he reacts to environment. None of these faculties can react to consciousness because they know nothing about it. Therefore, the inner life of man, when he turns in toward himself, is just the darkness. His faculties cannot explore it. Therefore, he does not know how to get out of the well. Even when he wishes to and turns within himself, he finds only mystery and darkness. That was the reason why the ancient peoples began their tremendous sense of discipline. Visualization, the gradual transference of certain centers of value from the outside to the inside, began this process of helping man to move in some way toward consciousness. The refinement of his values, the greater enrichment of his internal life, is seeking more and more on the inside and less on the outside. Actually, it was his way of climbing the wall of the well. For in man's case, he must climb this wall by going into his own source. For somewhere at the top of his own mysterious well, there is this bright patch of light in the sky. And this bright patch of light, which he sees from below, he calls spirit. But this thing that he calls spirit is the light, the sun, the natural luminance of another kind of condition, of which he is not aware. So in climbing toward spirit, he is climbing toward light, toward the normal and proper light of a real world. A world in which the things which interest him now would appear only as madness or nightmare. He cannot know what he's going to find there. But he may have the same experience as the man who climbed the well. He may discover that what he finds is merely a tremendous vista to be conceived, to be understood. But it is not a problem in which he is going to have to fight or defend himself. He is merely going to have to be amazed, to be surprised, to suddenly realize that this is the world that he always dreamed about. That here is the world in which the things that are meaningful in his few enlightened moments are truly significant and truly real. Therefore, that in this change there is no adjustment necessary other than the adjustment arising from the effort to climb the well. But by degrees, the individual who makes truth his journey, who suddenly resolves to find out the source of himself, the reason for his own being, is the one who ultimately escapes into consciousness. And by attempting this journey, he finds that he comes merely into the light of day. And he comes into an ordinary world. He comes into the normal universe, which to him is incredible. He discovers that heaven is nothing but the normal universe. That it is the thing as it is, rather than the thing which he has forced into a deformity. That so-called immortality is his natural state, not something that he must fight desperately to attain. There is nothing between him and all of these things except the courage required to climb the well. Their ancient systems of initiation and instruction were dedicated to giving the individual the courage to leave the world of darkness and of dreams and seek the world of light and of waking. And to awaken was the ancient symbol of the dawn of consciousness. Man awakens out of matter into consciousness. And what he calls the consciousness here in the state of matter is an awareness, but not a consciousness. Some way this awareness is rooted in consciousness, but not adequate to direct him without inspiration, without guidance, without benevolent leadership from more enlightened teachers and guides. But in all cases, what we are trying to do is to discover a superior state of consciousness, which may lead to health, may lead to many other things. Its complete acceptance is beyond us at the moment. Its complete experience we cannot now have. But if we accept the philosophy that this concept is essentially true, then we can begin to loosen the bonds which bind us to sensory orientation and escape by degrees the tyranny of attitudes and authority, the despotism of darkness, and we will slowly develop the adventurous insight which will lead us to climb out of the well. These things come to us from thought and meditation and reflection. And before we can make the journey, we must suddenly or in some way convince ourselves that this consciousness is not what we have now, but what we might have were we able to complete the journey of life. Thus, this consciousness to which we cease to return was that which was before the present state. It existed long before the people fell into the well. And it will exist after the last person has climbed out of the well. The world of the well is an incident. But the great world of life, which contains many wells, is a reality. The man moving up to it suddenly comes into normalcy, suddenly comes into common sense, value, and reality, and purpose. These are the elements of a very great drama that the ancients unfolded to us. Guess we'll have to leave these elements for the moment and come back to them again next week, because it looks like time is up.